This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Amid ambushes, car bombs, and the confusion of the occupation, Baghdad is also the unlikely destination of a 21st century gold rush. Reconstruction is a big part of it, but just about the entire Iraqi economy used to be controlled by the state, and much of it is likely to be privatized over the next year or so. A lot of companies are willing to bet that business will boom once security improves. That may look like a risky wager at the moment, but President Bush today took a step that his critics have urged for some time now. He will ask for a United Nations mandate in Iraq, though it's not yet clear how much control he's willing to give up in return. In a few minutes, we'll focus on the business of reconstruction in Iraq. If you have questions about which companies are getting the work, about the bidding process, and about what kind of economy makes sense for Iraq, give us a phone call. Our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Or you can send us an email at TOTN@NPR.org. But first to a possible new role for the United Nations in Iraq. The Bush administration is circulating a proposed resolution which gives a larger role to the UN United Nations. Earlier today, Secretary of State Colin Powell told reporters that the draft resolution proposes a multinational force under a unified American command. He said the United States would continue to play the dominant role and added,
"There are many roles to be played. And we believe that every peace-loving nation in the world, every nation that would like to see a more stable Middle East, that would like to see a democracy arise in that part of the world, would want to play a role, whether one might call it dominant or not dominant. It's important for us to come together as an international community, and this is a further step in that direction. It's an evolutionary step because it's a resolution I've been talking about for weeks. We just finally found it was time."
The draft resolution also calls on the Iraqi Governing Council to submit a timetable for holding elections and to eventually restore sovereignty to Iraq. Now, joining us to talk about what UN involvement could mean to the future of the American occupation is Ivo Dalder, a senior fellow of foreign policy studies at the Brookings Institution, and good to have you back on Talk of the Nation.
Good to be here.
So what is it exactly is Secretary of State Powell proposing?
Well, what it looks like he's proposing is a thin blanket under which he's trying to persuade other countries to join us in essentially the mission that we have been embarked upon since the end of the war, which is to stabilize Iraq and to find a way to get the Iraqi people to take control of their own lives in a way that is both ensures their stability and security, and hopefully, ultimately, the prosperity and democracy of that country. The question is, are we offering enough for countries that up to this point have not been willing to join us? Are we offering enough to them to make them change their minds?
To some degree, European countries that oppose this war in the first place, which dominate the Security Council, they're among the permanent members of the Security Council. What does this mean for their willingness to join up now? I mean, the Secretary of State says they're going to be relegated to a junior role. The United States will be dominant. At the same time, they're sure to be saying, at least behind closed doors, "I told you so."
Well, I think what the Europeans are saying is, if you want us to play a role, if you want our soldiers to be exposed to the same risks that your soldiers are being exposed to, then we want to have a role in the decision-making process. We want to have a role about where those forces go, what it is that those forces do, and where the country is going. And what Mr. Powell is putting on offer, and that, remember, this is an opening position that may change over time, but for now, he's offering is, why don't you join us on our own terms? We did this already in April and in May when we had the first UN resolution, which also encourages other countries in exactly the way that, Secretary Powell just said a few moments ago, encouraged other nations to join in the stabilization of Iraq. At that point, countries like France and Germany said, listen, we're not going to play the game according to your set of rules. We want to be able to determine and help determine those set of rules. We want the international community writ large and the United Nations to be in control of this process, not the United States. We don't want to be part of a coalition that is the occupying power. We weren't a part of the coalition that led to the war. So either we change the nature of the structure that exists within Iraq, that is, we put it under a UN mandate, and then we will participate, or we keep the same structure, but then we're not likely to join you.
So what has changed? As you said, the United States has taken a couple of bites at this already and may have incrementally moved, at least somewhat. Neither you nor I have seen the draft of this proposed resolution. But why now, do you think?
Well, I think there's clearly a sense within the administration, as we've gone through the summer and as both the political season heats up and Congress returns to town, that politically there are problems with what is happening in Iraq. Iraq is not moving in the right direction in many instances. Many Americans are unhappy with the direction that Iraq is moving. It is becoming more and more a political liability. Americans are dying in numbers that are far greater than anybody expected after the war was over. The cost of our involvement is extraordinarily high and rising, and we're bearing that burden largely on our own. 90% of the troops are American, 90% of the casualties are American, and 90% of the cost is American. And there is a growing sense in the country that says, you know, why is it that we are paying for all this? If this is so important for the rest of the world, why isn't the rest of the world joining us? And I think the administration is trying to respond to that sense, politically, that is here at home, by saying, well, in fact, we will ask other people to join us. Whether they will or not remains to be seen.
This all has, I guess, something of a timetable. In about 3 weeks' time, the President of the United States will go to New York and address the General Assembly of the United Nations, which he, of course, did last year as well.
Yes, and we'll see what he has to, you know, the next 3 weeks will be critical to see what he's going to say there. Is he going to thank the United Nations for embracing an American-led mission in Iraq and providing the kind of troops that we're looking for? Or is he, in fact, going to be disappointed that the UN has not joined the United States, as I think is more likely? And at that point, he has a strategic choice to make. He can either say, okay, we will do this by ourselves, largely with our coalition of the willing, and we will pay for it in both lives and in treasure in order, because we think this is the right thing to do. Or at that point, he can turn around and say, okay, you want more control? Here, have it. You can have more control. But if there is more control, then our role is neither going to be dominant. It's going to be minor in this part of the world. It is now up to you, the United Nations and our allies, to determine what you want.
Ivo Dalder, thanks very much.
My pleasure.
Ivo Dalder is a senior fellow for foreign policy studies at the Brookings Institution. He joined us from his office here in Washington, D.C. Well, Iraq's economy, both the present and the future, will be our topic for the remainder of this hour. The first big flows of cash into the country right now are in the form of multi-million dollar contracts to major companies who are trying to address the most crucial of Iraq's needs. One of the federal agencies awarding those contracts is the U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID. Joining us now from their office in Washington is Wendy Chamberlain, Assistant Administrator for Asia and the Near East. And thanks very much for being with us today.
Well, thank you.
The contracting process for companies to rebuild Iraq has raised a lot of criticism for not being open to enough companies, especially not American companies. Why aren't there more bidders in this?
Well, I think there were quite a few bidders in this. Every single one of the contracts that USAID let was contested, had several bidders on it. For example, the largest, and I think the one that is in the press the most, was the large infrastructure contract. We had seven companies bid in a highly competitive hot contest for that. Bechtel won the contract, and I think they won it because they presented the best bid for it. They've certainly performed well on the ground.
Thus far, have contracts been let out to non-American companies?
Subcontracts have been let out to non-Americans, but all of the contracts, the prime contracts that AID let initially, have all been American contracts.
And is there a reason for that?
Well, there would require a waiver on our administrator, Andrew Natsios, would have to waive it to include internationals as a prime. He did not. What he did do was to exercise his authority to permit international companies to bid as subcontractors. And quite a few internationals have competed for those subcontracts and won. In fact, one of our goals in the reconstruction project is to employ and involve as many Iraqis as we possibly can in rebuilding their own country, and many have won those subcontracts. Of course, the Iraqi people and the Iraqi governing council is very much involved in the decision-making in the reconstruction of Iraq.
You said a waiver was required?
According to our regulations, yes.
That's
waiver is required.
Regulations require an American company if all things are equal.
A waiver was required to open it up to international companies. Otherwise, it would be American companies.
Okay, I see. Now, we hear a lot about the biggest contracts, and you mentioned Bechtel for maintaining utilities and rebuilding the government. How extensive, though, is the work we're funding?
It's quite extensive, but I think Jerry Bremer was back here talking to the press just last week, and he was anticipating an even greater involvement in those kinds of decisions are being thrashed around at this time. But the needs are great. We are, of course, as you well know, seeing some obstacles in the reconstruction project, and I think those have been eloquently framed by the speaker before me. But these are obstacles that we are facing. We're the United States government. We are pledged and committed to doing what is right by the Iraqi people. After all, the reconstruction of Iraq is for the Iraqi people and in their benefit. And we will continue to work until we succeed.
The results of what these companies that you're contracting out to, the results of what they do is going to be felt in Iraq for a very long time to come. How much do Iraqis get to say in what they're doing now?
Well, that is a very high priority on the part of Jerry Bremer and the CPA to involve as many Iraqi in the decision-making process as possible. We're working very closely with the Iraqi Governing Council, and of course the news today is that the Iraqi Governing Council has appointed cabinets in each one of the ministries. More and more of the decisions for the reconstruction will be passed to the ministries, headed by the minister, including the next budget that is being considered right now. So it's a process, and it's in work. And with each passing week, with each passing month, more and more of the decisions are being passed to more and more Iraqis. That is our goal, and that is what is happening.
You mentioned a lot of the subcontracts are going to Iraqis. Who decides who gets the subcontracts? Is that the contractor, or is that AID?
No, that is not AID. AID does not have anything to do with the subcontract. That is a decision made by the prime. But let me point out that these AID contracts is just a very small part of the reconstruction effort. We've only spent about $1 billion since May on this program, and that's just a small piece of the work that's being done. There's more work being done, and as you well know, we hope that there'll be more international involvement and more UN involvement, as there will should be in this.
We just have a few seconds left with you. How would it be different if there is a UN mandate?
Well, one would hope that that other countries who have held back would be politically covered to participate in a larger way in Iraq. We certainly welcome that, as do the Iraqi people.
But the fundamental structure, you think, would remain the same?
Well, I actually am not in a position to address that. I think that's among the issues that are being discussed right now.
Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Wendy Chamberlain is Assistant Administrator for Asia and the Near East for USAID, and she was speaking with us from her offices here in Washington, D.C. We're going to go to a short break now, and when we come back, more on the economics of reconstructing Iraq, on the gargantuan task of remaking an economy from the ground up, and later on, the debate over whether or not to privatize Iraq's major industries. If you have thoughts or questions, our phone number is 800-989-8255, our email address, totn@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're discussing reconstruction and international business interests in Iraq. You're invited to join the discussion, as always. Our phone number is 800-989-8255. The email address, totn@npr.org. And joining us now is Neil King, Jr., the Wall Street Journal's reporter on this subject. He's with us from his office here in Washington. Good to have you on Talk of the Nation.
Hi, Neil. How are you?
Good. Before the break, we were speaking with Wendy Chamberlain from USAID about the process for distributing Iraqi rebuilding contracts. Do you think that she adequately addressed the controversy that's been raised in about this process?
I suppose relatively well. There has been quite a large fuss made, particularly out of Congress. Some of it's been on the mark, more or less. Some of it's been rather unfair in other ways. I mean, it was a very peculiar process if you go back to the early part of this year, where the administration was both preparing to wage war on a country and preparing at the same time to rebuild it, at the same time as they were debating various things at the UN and insisting that no decision to go to war had been decided, or had the president had not made a decision. So it was a thing where, in a way, they were having to prepare for the peace more or less in secret. So they were putting together these various contracts starting at the end of last year and then into the early part of this year long before it was really known to the rest of the country that this was going on. So when it finally did come out and these contracts were let and so on, it was all surrounded by a very strange kind of atmosphere of almost profiteering off of war in the middle of the war. And there was such an atmosphere at the time when you kept bringing up this issue of who was going to benefit, what sort of companies, where Congress and others were really insisting that only American companies or coalition countries be the ones that benefit. I mean, it's certainly shifted a lot now, where instead of being a kind of prize, the way we look at Iraq, we're looking at Iraq as being increasingly a burden, where we're sort of beseeching others to come in and help share that burden, when just months ago it was sort of, the atmosphere was much more, this is all ours and we're going to have it for ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Let's get a caller involved. Dan joins us on the line from Syracuse, New York.
Yes, very interesting topic. I'm glad you have a chance to talk about it today. I would say that it makes no difference on who gets those contracts, international or American, but as far as the interest of protecting the American dollar, it obviously should be American companies. But what concerns me is not the focus on that so much as the focus that should be more intense, I believe, on the no-bid process and the, I really believe, some inside trader business. For example, Halliburton, which is the company that's the former CEO, now currently the Vice President of the United States. I really think, Neil, that needs some close scrutiny, and I think there's some evidence there to show that maybe some hanky-panky going on. I just don't think that's been brought to the public's attention at full swing.
Neil King, there has been a lot of controversy and speculation that the President's or the Vice President's cronies and business partners have gotten an inside track.
Yeah, the process where Halliburton, the Kellogg Brown and Root subsidiary of Halliburton, got the contracts for doing oil repair work, which went through the Army Corps of Engineers, has certainly been much more opaque than the other process, which all went through AID, the Bechtel contract, and things like that, they had limited competition, essentially, where it was seven or eight companies, as Ms. Chamberlain explained earlier. I have not actually spent a lot of time looking at the Halliburton contract, and it may well be the case that there were some shenanigans surrounding it, though I sometimes doubt if it's necessarily as simple as people might think, where Dick Cheney would call up and kind of ask that a contract be awarded to a company that he once used to head, but maybe it actually does work that way.
Dan, it's a good question, and we will continue to follow it as we learn more about it. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Neil King, European companies especially have complained about being shut out of this bidding process. Is there evidence that, obviously, as you say, the award to the Halliburton people was a little opaque. There was, limited bidding available in to the USAID contracts?
Yeah, it was a limited competition. It was done sort of under national security aegis in a way at the time, considering that they wanted it to happen quickly. And the like, it's Congress that in some ways has actually tied the hands of AID and other contractors in terms of their ability just to award these things kind of willy-nilly around the world. And it's also, not to leap too much to their defense, but a rather complex thing for you know, a Kuwaiti company to interact with the U.S. government when it comes to contracting, just because it's such a bureaucratic thing. And if companies haven't had that experience doing that before, it becomes rather difficult. That's one of the reasons that they feed these things through a prime contractor like Bechtel, when in the end, in Iraq, much of this work is actually going to companies that are doing work out of other countries.
How are Iraqi businesses reacting to the U.S. Proposals to restructure their economy?
When I was there, which was a couple of months ago, and I want to get back within a month or so to see how things have changed, there was huge consternation among Iraqi businessmen about what the rules would be. They were particularly concerned about sort of opening the borders just willy-nilly to foreign investment pouring in, and very much wanted there to be some kinds of restrictions on the percentage of ownership that foreign companies could have, which is typical in these kinds of environments. Those rules are really still being worked out, and probably will be for some time. There was a delegate that was just sent there recently, or a new official that's joining the CPA, a kind of Bush friend of sorts from Connecticut, who is going to be handling a lot of the private sector matters and looking into this whole privatization debate. And it's really hard to say how they're going to go forward with that, and really what condition these companies are for privatizing in the first place. One thing that's certainly clear is that at least for the time being, they're going to stay completely away from the oil industry, which is by far the big hot button when it comes to anything resembling privatization.
Well, at the same time, Paul Bremer, who's the American official overseeing things there in Iraq, has opened the country to some international trade and actually put some incentives in place for imports. What effect is that having on the Iraqi economy now?
Well, one thing that's, incentives is pretty much the word, considering that basically it became like the most free market economy, one of the most free market economies in the world all at once, because they just dropped all tariffs. And the only real restrictions are on the export of livestock and things like that, because they're concerned about there being a protein deficit and things like that. Otherwise, I mean, when I was there, and I'm certain it's the case still, there was just extraordinary amounts of consumer goods just pouring into the country, and just amazing amounts. I mean, truckloads of televisions and air conditioners and satellite dishes and cars by the zillions really coming in from Jordan and such places. So at least on the kind of, you know, let's spend our money quick and improve our lives quickly by a television or an air conditioner, there's huge amounts of that. That's, of course, a small slice of an economy, and there's huge, deep endemic problems across most of the rest of the economy that are going to take a lot longer to figure out, probably along the lines of what we saw in the Soviet Union or in other parts of Eastern Europe.
Now, one of the things we think of when we think of a big economy like Iraq's, obviously oil is the first thing you think of, but almost everything in that country was a state-run business. I mean, the tobacco industry, the candy industry, everything was state-owned.
It was and it wasn't. You know, I was a little surprised in my time there, actually, meeting a lot of these old trading families, like the Baniya family and the Janabis and these various families that have been there since Ottoman times. And even candy, for instance, they actually had their own candy factories, which basically went broke, sort of at least shut down through much of the 90s because there was no sugar around. But there actually was more sort of, it was state-oriented, definitely, and there was a lot of state ownership and a lot of kind of padding of backs, to say the least, between the government and the industries. But there actually was and remains a fair amount of private entrepreneurship of sorts. I think it's been rather distorted over the last 20 years, but it survives and will probably make up the core part of the economy going forward. I think the challenge, in a way, is to try to get beyond that sort of oligarchy of sorts and to try to create sort of new generation on the sides of that.
Let's get another question in, and this is Jim, who joins us from Butte County. Is that right, in California?
Yes, sir. It's in Northern California, about 100 miles north of Sacramento. And I wanted to comment on a comment that one of your guests mentioned, that there weren't any predictions that this would be an expensive quagmire. And indeed, there were plenty of well-informed analysts who thought that this was going to be an expensive quagmire after we got into it. And I also want to remind the listeners that the whole problem was created from a coup in 1963 that put Saddam Hussein into power after the leader of Iraq, Abdul Qasim, helped to create OPEC, and that the CIA and the British intelligence was very involved with recruiting Saddam Hussein to participate in that coup. And my question has to do with how much Halliburton's subsidiary, Kellogg Brown and Root, was able to capitalize on this war by setting up military bases in the region, as they did in Yugoslavia. It's an important question that has to do not with just post-Iraq, but the pre-Iraq invasion, how much they profited from setting up this invasion.
Okay, Jim, we'll leave your historical questions about coups in the past aside, but it's a good question. Neil King, there were a lot of bases that were used to mount this war. Was Halliburton and other big companies involved in that?
Yeah, very much so. I mean, it's sort of an adage of sorts that the U.S. Army doesn't really go much of anywhere without Kellogg, Brown, and Root tagging along, and that's been the case, as far as I know, since the Vietnam War or thereabouts. They are the provisioner of choice, in a way, for the U.S. Army, and I've been on bases in Bosnia and in a variety of places where, you know, most of the stuff bears the stamp of Kellogg, Brown, and Root. There are other similar provisioners or contractors that do work like that for the Air Force and others, but it is the case that Kellogg, Brown, and Root did huge amounts of work in establishing various of these bases, and either in the longer term or much more immediately, and then build up to Iraq. As to how much they profited, I have no idea, but I'm sure that the work was not without some gain.
There are those who question, maybe not the first round of contracts. Obviously, electricity has to be restored. Roads have to work. Schools have to be reopened. Those sorts of things have to move along. But in terms of fundamental questions about what the Iraqi economy is going to look like, those kinds of decisions are being made, too. And a lot of people question whether the United States really does have the authority to go ahead and do this without an elected Iraqi government to okay it and give it some legitimacy.
Yeah, no, I agree completely. There's, you know, there were documents that came out earlier on in the spring that were kind of sketching out these just like sweeping transformations of the Iraqi economy that were rather extraordinary. That we'd never seen anything like that, where a government was kind of contemplating doing, except maybe going back to Germany or Japan or something after the Second World War. In the end, I think as it's actually played out, for one, some of the things that resemble an Iraqi government are starting to come into place, and I think the consultation on the budget front and others is actually pretty intense and going on as we speak at the moment in Baghdad, that a lot of the bigger questions when it comes to privatization of state enterprises and things like that will be made, at least in real consultation with the Iraqis, if not actually made by Iraqis. It's hard to say how many things will be decided necessarily that are irreversible, and that is one of the things that's actually problematic in a way, in that for all the desire for investors to come in and things, investors have no desire to really get into Iraq, thinking that whatever decision that the Americans might make now would be reversed by a next government and therefore would possibly jeopardize what they want to do. So it's what I'm saying is that it's hard to say that they've made anything that's irreversible, but that kind of limbo is itself part of the problem of the Iraqi economy at the moment.
And interestingly, today I think they punted a decision on telecommunications, deciding which wireless system to use, either one that's compatible with Western European countries and most of the Middle East, or one that's compatible with American companies. A decision yet to be made on that.
Yeah, this is one of the great debates.
Neil King, thanks very much for being with us today.
Pleasure. Take care.
Neil King is one of the Wall Street Journal reporters who's been following the story about Iraq and reconstruction and money. He kindly squeezed some time out under deadline to join us today from their offices here in Washington, D.C. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. So far in the program, we've talked with people who hand out money and the bigger picture about where it's going. Now we turn to what this looks like on the ground. Joining us now is Cliff Mumm, Program Manager for Bechtel's Iraq Reconstruction Program. He's calling us from Bechtel's Baghdad camp, and thanks very much for being with us today.
Yeah, well, thank you for having me.
What's the setup there?
I'm sorry. There's a slight delay in the line. You might try that again.
I apologize. I was just asking what the setup is there. There's been a lot in the news about continued security problems and sabotage around the country. How much does that get in the way of your efforts?
On some of the programs, we're working on fairly basic infrastructure, and on some of the programs that we are working on, it does cause problems. For example, one of the things we're doing is rebuilding about 1,000 elementary and secondary schools around about 12 different cities or urban areas in Baghdad. And waiting out in the community is always, you know, kind of a security challenge, actually.
How much of this work is being contracted out, and who's getting those subcontracts?
Yeah, well, that's an interesting question, actually, Neil. One of the things that we've done, you know, the $680 million contract that we have was in part to get the infrastructure rebuilt, but it also was intended to, as we did that, to spur on the Iraqi economy and get it started again. So about 70% of the work that we're doing are going to first, second, and third tier Iraqi subcontractors, people who were working and have been in Iraq before. The other 30% is actually going to some things that really couldn't be provided by the Iraqis, for instance, dredging the port at Umm Qasr, which we did with Great Lakes Dredging, and as well some of the high-tech things that you still don't have the experience with in Iraq, airport communications, air traffic control, that sort of thing.
Can you take a call with a listener with us?
Sure.
Joining us now on the line is Anne, who's in Philadelphia. And Anne, you're on the air.
Good afternoon. I just have a comment and a question. We know that Halliburton and Bechtel were given exclusive rights for the rebuilding of Iraq. And at this point, we know that a lot of money has already been paid for this work. My question is, will we ever really know exactly what Halliburton and Bechtel have been paid for? In other words, you're a representative of Bechtel, so would you please tell me as a citizen, what are you being paid for exactly, and are you going to meet all of your responsibilities, your business responsibilities, before we see these recent changes come into play?
Well, certainly I can answer that, Anne. And it's nice that you're calling from Philadelphia. That's my home as well. I live up on Washington Square, so it's nice somebody from a hometown is calling. As far as the work that, what we're being paid for the work we're doing in Iraq, our contract is for $680 million. We by no means have exclusive rights to do the infrastructure rebuilding in Iraq. We're just one of others that are doing that. And certainly there'll be more as the investment increases, if it does increase. The work that we're doing is a really basic infrastructure work. For example, at the port of Umm Qasr, if I could just run through this, we've actually dredged the port out. I think one of the things that never got reported very well after the war was really the state of disrepair and the sort of environmental debacle that Iraq really is. For example, the port of Umm Qasr hadn't received, it's the only port they have, and it couldn't get deep draft ships. The grain that was coming in on the oil for food program was actually being diverted and sold in Syria. When we got to the port and started dredging the port, we also started cleaning out the grain silos, something Bechtel doesn't normally do, but we found they were infested with rats and birds and all sorts of things, and really had to go through a whole cleanup there. The idea was to allow food to again come into Iraq through the port.
Cliff, Mom, I hate to interrupt you, but we're going to have to take a short break. Can you stay with us for 2 minutes?
Sure.
We'll come back to you in 2 minutes and follow up on this question. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Just before the break, we were speaking with Cliff Mumm, the program manager for Bechtel's Iraq Reconstruction Program, and he was answering an important question from a caller named Ann in Philadelphia about exactly what the taxpayers were paying for in Iraq. And Cliff Mumm, you did not have a chance to get to the other part of Ann's question, which was, if I can paraphrase what she was saying, is there ever going to be an independent evaluation or audit of the job that you guys are doing out there?
Oh, actually, we're audited. We've been being audited since the very beginning. The government auditing agency, DCAA, have been out and have been auditing our work all along. So, it's being independently audited.
I'm sorry, who's that?
The DCAA, the auditing agency for the federal government, has been auditing all along.
So
there is an independent audit that goes along with this job, the whole period of the job.
As you look around at what needs to be done, and you were talking eloquently before the break about some of the major problems, what's the biggest challenge right now?
I think the biggest challenge right now, really there's two, and it's primary infrastructure. One is water. From before the war, every ounce of sewage in Iraq goes into the Tigris and the Euphrates River, every bit of it. They were using, Saddam was using the sewage treatment plants to store diesel. And, of course, when that water moves down south, everybody starts drinking that. None of the water treatment plants in the south work at all. And they're working the canal that carries water from the south, I mean from the north to the south, is actually working at about a quarter of the capacity that it was or was designed to. So the people in Basra are getting about a quarter of the amount of water they actually need. The other one is electricity. The electrical infrastructure in Iraq was 30 years old, defunct and decrepit, some of it because of sanctions and some of it just because there was no investment for the past 25, 30 years. And it's all working at about 40% capacity, and it's critical that we get that fixed. To compound that, the whole grid system, that is the transmission lines in Iraq, when we first came here, there were about 13 of the transmission towers down. Today there's a whopping 650 of those transmission towers which have been destroyed. Ironically, they've been destroyed to salvage and harvest the copper in many cases, so it isn't sabotage as much as it is to be able to sell the copper. So it's been quite a startling thing. There isn't much of an electrical grid left in Iraq, so there's a real effort now to get electricity back and get the grid back up and working, as well as water.
Cliff Mumm, thanks very much for staying up late there to talk with us. We appreciate it.
You bet. Thank you.
Cliff Mumm is Bechtel's program manager for their Iraq Infrastructure Reconstruction Program, and he was speaking with us from their camp in Baghdad.